everyone. My name is Nada Ahmed, and I'm your host for the Braving Innovation Podcast. I help businesses innovate and bring new products and services to market. I believe every company and team can achieve immense success in creating sustainable and profitable business models. All you need is an agile leadership mindset to build powerful, high-performing teams. Get access to proven tools and strategies for impactful growth and the ability to get the right mentors and investors on board. In this podcast, I want to help you with all of that. So I will be bringing you inspiring stories, tips, and strategies from leaders all around the world so that you can excel on your journey as an entrepreneur, innovation leader, and investor. Welcome to Braving Innovation.
Today, I'm really excited to have with me Kurt Davis. Kurt spent the first 20 years of his career in Silicon Valley and Asia, working in corporate venture capital and business development for technology startups, where he focused on deals with Apple, Microsoft, Spotify, Sony, and more. In 2017, he took off to Africa, where he volunteered at many emerging business accelerators and humanitarian nonprofits, and then he also ended up writing a book, which is called Finding Soul from Silicon Valley to Africa. So you have to check that out. But today we'll spend most of our time talking about his newest book, which is called Navigate to the Lighthouse, a Silicon Valley guide to executing global deals. In this book, he returns to his startup roots. When he spoke to other entrepreneurs, Kurt realized that many get stuck in their initial market, but few leap the chasm to bigger opportunities. Readers will learn how to effectively use strategic business development as they pursue trajectory-changing deals, giving them the courage to go after what before seemed like impossible deals. So really excited to get into all of this with you. But I thought, just for us to get to know you a little bit, maybe you could kind of describe, sure. You know, I gave a brief bio, but in your own words, how did you get into entrepreneurship and venture capital? How did your career actually begin in this field?
Well, entrepreneurship was kind of in my dad's blood. He always wanted to own his own tax practice, and he did that. And then I started a landscaping business in high school, and I kind of always liked the idea of doing something on my own. And so that was kind of in our blood. And then, you know, kind of had finance chops, and I was good at math, so I, you know, kind of thought that would be a good area to go into. But I also had this interest in Asia coming out of college, and Davidson College had a lot of study abroad programs and encouraged students to go abroad. And so I actually went out to Japan and taught English, and just through a friend, I was able to get a job in kind of corporate venture capital. And it was kind of a lucky job. I probably didn't deserve it, but you know, they gave me a shot and was an analyst for a few years. And then I decided, go ahead.
This was in Japan.
This was in Hong Kong. So I went from Japan to Hong Kong. And then I left there and went to China and to kind of study some Chinese. And then I got the bug and decided I would start a little mobile phone game company. So I did that for a few years. And then during that time, I was able to meet some Silicon Valley investors, you know, namely Kleiner and Sequoia. And I was like, well, if I'm going to do a company, I might as well move to the Bay Area. So I moved to the Bay Area in 2006, got back into corporate venture capital with the Japanese firm Mitsui, one of the shogoshoshas. And then I decided to jump back into the startup game and worked at this company called Boku, which I worked at for 7 years, which is the premise to the book Navigate to the Lighthouse, talks about our journey there. And that also took me back to Asia, where we built out the Asian business in 2013. And incidentally, bought a company in India, spent time down there in Singapore and the Middle East. So it was a really kind of amazing global experience that I was given. And then decided I got burned out. I was finished. We'd worked on all these deals and decided I would take some time off of tech and decided to go to Africa because I hadn't seen that continent before. And so decided I would just go travel, backpack, and did these interesting things. And people connected me to other people and wrote a book about it when I got back. Didn't think about writing a book about it, but when I got back, I had all these blog posts and decided I would try to write this book. And the pandemic hit, and so the lockdown hit, so I wrote the other book. So incidentally, the people in Africa asked me to write a book about business development, so I built this presentation And I took the presentation and I just made a book out of it with some editors and help. And so that's how we got there. And now I'm here.
Yeah. No, it's really fun to listen to you talk about your journey, because I feel like I've had a similar journey myself. Like, I just love traveling and experiencing new cultures. And when I was in college, I thought I wanted to be a doctor, but I realized, like, I studied abroad in college too. I studied in France and I learned French and, you know, embraced myself in the culture. And I was like, you know, I think I need to enter a field that's going to allow me to travel more. And throughout my career, I've used every opportunity to kind of go in and out and, like, you know, travel along with my career as my career grows. And not many people can envision that that is actually possible. You can do that, right? Because people think that you have to take a break from your career to be able to do that. But it seems like you've been able to combine your passion for traveling while at the same time working on things that you find meaningful.
Right. And it was lucky I was able to do that. And there's not a ton of those jobs out there, but you know, if you can get one, it's worth a shot. So, but you kind of have to invest in it, like you did. You went out to learn French and you traveled and you created a piece of your resume yourself that had this international component that companies would value. So
absolutely. So it seems like from what you described, you started off in investing, kind of venture capital, but you've always been an entrepreneur at heart. And so Boku, the way I understand it, is a tech startup. Is that correct?
Boku was a tech startup. It was the first business hire, and they were building APIs that connected mobile phone carriers around the world to large social media companies, primarily Facebook, social game companies, Zynga, all this stuff back in the day. And then as the company evolved, we did things like Sony, PlayStation, Microsoft, Xbox, Netflix, and then we did some big deals with iTunes. And so if you're on iTunes, for example, and you live in Japan or India or Germany, you can, on your iTunes, you can top up your credits just by billing it to your carrier, your mobile phone bill. And so instead of these companies going directly to all the carriers in the world, they could just come to Boku and we could do it all for them. Okay. So there's a lot of tremendous value add. So we built that big network, and the company is listed on the London Stock Exchange, and it's still enduring, as they would say.
And so were you one of the founders of the company?
No, I was the first business hire. So I came in with the founders, incidentally. Mm-hmm. They all kind of joined at the same time and recruited me at the same time. So I wasn't a founder per se, but I was there along the ride with them, because they came in. The company that they actually joined was existing. It wasn't started. So it was a company that was spawned by the investors. They invested it and they brought in this management team, and the management team built it. And so it was a different animal than a founder-led company.
What do you think are the advantages and disadvantages of having a company that's founded by...
I think it's highly underrated to have investors as the majority shareholder. And I think the general notion is, in fact, some VC just turned us down because of this, but they're saying we want the founder to have, you know, majority and all this, you know, power, just be really excited about everything. And that's fine and all, but you also comes with a lot of problems sometimes. And the problems become when, like, you need to make changes, the founder's not doing a good job, doesn't want to move out of their seat, and these other things. But in this case, it worked out really well because, you know, everyone had enough shares. We were kind of all happy with what we had. We enjoyed building the company. And, you know, it was also, you know, if things didn't work out, like, you know, you have to be moved around. So, but I think it worked out fine. I don't think, to me, there was not much of a difference. The CEO and the co-founder, the theoretical CEO and co-founder, who, you know, didn't have over, you know, probably 25% of the company when they were given it to him by investors, were completely happy with that deal. And they were also, you know, got paid a salary and I think got good shares. So, like, I think there's lots of people out there. And I think there's a tremendous group, experienced technology professionals who I think would jump on opportunities to become a CEO of an early stage funded company and get 15% of that company, 10 or 15%, and go build and don't have to be a founder. Like you don't have to. It's like, oh, there's this really cool thing and it's going actually kind of well, but it needs somebody with a lot of good experience. So we'll just add these really three, four really smart people to go do it. And I think that's a great thing. Like the investors already invested. They're already committed. And so I don't know. It's a different way to look at it. It's a different way to look at playing the game. And I think it's not a bad thing to do. I think it's a good thing.
Okay. But are there any pitfalls?
Well, the biggest risk is if you don't do your job, you're going to get fired.
But okay.
Fine. And if you're a founder and you want to control everything and you don't want to give up any control to a really good investor, then you're not going to get the money. So like, I don't know. Like, is there pitfalls?
No.
You got to learn to work with people.
Yeah.
Like, that's a pitfall.
Yeah. Just like any other job, I guess. Yeah. So what do you think was the biggest challenge of getting this startup, Baku? Is that a Japanese name, by the way?
So it is a Japanese name, but it was never intended that way. In fact, I still don't understand where it came from. And so that was always like, until we went to Japan, and the irony of the whole thing is it became 80% Japanese company. So like the people called it Boku, we go to Japan and they're like Boku, and Boku means I in Japanese. Okay. Like, so Watashi is I. But then Boku is like, I, informal, strong, like I'm putting myself over you. So when we would be in these meetings, we'd talk and then we'd say Boku and, you know, speak Japanese. So like we get to Boku, da, da, da. They're like, you're calling me Boku at a business meeting, which is like totally faux pas, right? And so anyway, so that's still kind of a funny story.
Yeah, interesting.
Never intended, you know.
Yeah. But what do you think was the biggest challenge in working with Boku to really get it to where it ended up being, which was listed in the stock exchange?
Well, I think Boku could have failed many times. And there was many times where it was like, this is the end. And it wasn't a clear business, to be honest. There were some competitors and it was very local heroes or people all over the world doing in this in their Germany or Italy or UK or Norway. And, you know, people kind of thought it maybe could evolve into something big like Korea and Japan. Really, where carrier billing was big, but you know, I think one instance was we had to get the Facebook deal because all the traffic on the social game started to run through Facebook, and that was the only place really where the money was being made. And so either we dig in, our competitor got the Facebook deal first, and then we finally got it, and so that kept us alive. And then we ended up, it was really a deal by deal game. There wasn't a massive market for this, so we were trying to grab any deal we could, and then this company was skyrocketing in the online game space called Riot Games. And we got that deal and that took off, was about as big as Facebook. And then Facebook was going to, you know, get rid of payments, or Facebook was getting rid of social games. That was dying. And then we looked at mobile, but Google and Apple owned all of mobile and they didn't let separate payments people in. So the only thing we could do is get deals with Google and Apple and then maybe a long-term deal. So basically we were putting the whole bet of the company on chasing these big deals. And we had to have it funded long enough that, you know, investors had to fund it long enough to get those deals. And they did. They stuck around. Probably because they owned a majority of the company. So they kept funding it. And so at any given time, this company, you know, could have died if we didn't get into Facebook. It could have died if we didn't get into Riot Games. And it definitely would have died if we get into Sony's deal, which led us to the Apple deal. And then, you know.
Yeah, I think that story probably a lot of founders listening can relate to. If you are a startup, work with a startup, you know, every deal can be the deal breaker. Every deal can be the deal that if you don't win, you're going to die because you don't have funding. You're not going to be able to show to the next investor that you have enough in revenue, that you are getting traction in the market.
Yeah, and hopefully you don't want to be in a business. This is, I would never suggest to be in this business where your lifeline is predicated on getting two or three deals. Like, you should have a market where there's plenty of companies you can work with or deals you can get. But this just happened to be that case. And because of that, we learned how to do these very big, complicated, long-term deals that I thought was somewhat unique, that I thought, well, we could share this in a book because not many people will have gone through this to the extent that we did.
So could you share then with the audience some of the tips that you share in the book around how do you win these big deals that are actually going to make it or break it for your company?
Sure. There's a lot of nuggets in the book and they're kind of buried in the reading, but the book is parsed into three areas. The first area is really how do you plan, strategize, plan, and start to create a list of potential deals and then funnel those down into where you target your resources. Okay. So that's like the first part is like really thinking through this, talking, you know, analyzing, talking to them, getting out there. And then before you really decide where you're homing in on. And the second part is kind of how do you work with your team? How do you get your team into the deal? Because these deals take a lot of people. They might take your CEO, your board members, your investors, your engineers, the janitors, like who knows? Like these take everything you got to get this thing over the goal line. So get the team involved. How do you resource the team? How do you kind of maneuver the ship a little bit in terms of strategy? Do you need to make some acquisitions to make your product to fit the gaps in your product that they need? And then the last part is called the secret sauce, which is like really how you get them to move. Like how do you get the lighthouse to dance? And how do you get them to really commit to you? You know, and I say these are the five C's of closing. You know, you're consulting, you're collaborating, you're getting them to commit, you're closing, and then customer success. And so that's the last part of it.
I often find that, and this is something I write about in my book, is collaboration, not only sort of with the customer, but also within the team is a big struggle, right? You spoke about point number two in your book was like, how do you get your team to work together? So could you share with us, how do you build that environment in your team so that you're truly collaborating and not like competing against each other, but you know, how do you build that?
Yeah, I think always you'll get the question from the team members, why are we doing this? Or why are we investing so much in this project? And if the team's not all together on understanding where you're going in the vision, the common shared vision, then you're going to get people pulling other ways or refusing to want to work with you on the deals. So that shared vision, everyone needs to get on board and understand that and then move that way. So I think that's the first part. And the second part is, you know, they have to work with their departments to understand how much of the resources go into these deals, like, you know, and to really understand how that affects maybe their compensation or whatever else, but to understand the time commitments and whatnot that they are required to do. And I think those are two things we talk about.
Yeah. And I think that's super critical so that everyone's kind of aligned with the vision, right? The way that, where are you going? But then leaving, obviously, room for them to be creative and run in an autonomous way, as long as they know, okay, this is the direction where we're going and why we're going here. So who's kind of responsible for setting that direction?
I think it can be, you know, the business development leader who's ever leading that deal need to make the case that this is the direction, these are the resources we should be going. And then that person needs to make the case to their executive team to get the buy-off to do that while they're juggling interest. They might be juggling something and say, okay, well, we're not going to put all our eggs in this basket, but we definitely want to work on these big deals. So maybe 30% of the company is going to have to start working on those. Well, like in our case, we had kind of 30% of the company working on these big deals, hoping one of them was going to drop after Facebook, because we had it kind of hedge our bets. The 30% of the company was managing the existing business, making the existing product better, making Facebook happy, making Riot Games happy, XYZ. And then 30% of the company actually was working on other stuff in different geographies. And they were thinking, well, maybe this is what we should be doing, a parking in Europe. And so, because we didn't really know, like if all these deals didn't work out, then maybe something over here would hit. And then it started to become very obvious that even though these projects we were working on weren't working, they did give us some value. They gave us some value of interesting innovation. Mm. And these companies actually liked it that we were doing that. But over time, as the big companies started to show that they were going to work with us, we slowly turned off that business, the third aspect. And we were able then to focus on existing business and the new projects.
Yeah. And I guess what I'm hearing from there is like a very iterative approach, right? You're learning from each deal, from each customer as you're going along. So I'm sure you've had to pivot your core service several times.
So there's a lot of experimentation. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't say there's necessarily a pivot. But mm-hmm. it was trying to figure out what's next. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, this is the crossing the chasm issue. Like, what is next? What lighthouse deal is going to open up the mm-hmm. market for shine light on all these new opportunities that work? Mm-hmm. And you can chase the wrong lighthouse deal. You can invest in it, the wrong thing, and get nowhere. And mm-hmm. so the trick is trying to allocate enough resources to enough projects, but not too many, and then get the one that is going to be the real lighthouse, the true lighthouse.
And that's kind of, you know, perhaps the lean startup methodology where you're like quickly learning and experimenting from a lot of these different deals and know, okay, which one is actually going to go. And then once you start getting some feedback, some data, then you go for that one deal.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. And it's an iterative, you said iterative, it's learning, mm-hmm. it's making educated bets, expected value bets, all these types of things. I talk about mm-hmm. this in the book.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other thing, since, you know, you have a very international profile, how do you help companies, particularly those, you know, I spent a lot of time in Europe, that are maybe operating or founded in smaller markets, how do they then get connected to bigger markets, to China and to the US, et cetera?
Well,
how do they grow in other markets than their home market?
I think, you know, there's obviously some VCs are very helpful in helping their companies go global now. But I think, you know, there's always a question of when to go international. I mean, if you're well funded and you've got the resources, you can, you know, find the right people. There's ways to do it if you don't have a lot of money. Find consultants on the ground, market entry specialists, people to kind of investigate the market for you. Best case scenario is they're the company that takes you to a new market, like a big company that says, we love your technology. In this case, Sony took us to Japan. Like, we weren't really sure what Japan would offer, but Sony, which was actually based in San Diego, was like, we need the PlayStation. We need you all to light up the carriers in Japan so we don't have to integrate new APIs. We just wanted to integrate your API. So so we went and did that. So, you know, having a company take you is mm-hmm. another way. Sometimes you get pulled. Like, sometimes if you're a technology company, you have something really unique, like somebody in Australia or somebody somewhere else might buy your technology and it might be your first customer or two. Mm-hmm. And you want to go do that, but you have to be careful that it's not going to be a distraction because it's pulling you halfway across the world. So I think international expansion, there's a lot of discuss, you know, how soon do you do it? How fast? How do you do it? When do you like not focus on your market to go to other markets? These are all questions that you have to consider before you do that, because geography is, you know, important. Mm-hmm. And winning a geography can be important early in the game, a startup mm-hmm. game.
Mm-hmm. So if you go back to kind of the audience for the book, you know, if you could kind of give us a short pitch on who is it for? Who should actually pick up this book and read it, and what will they get out of it?
Well, the broad one is anybody who's in business development and sales, who's going from like a sales 101 to wanting to work on really large scale, you know, instrumental deals for your company. More specifically, it's VP of business development, your CRO, possibly CEO, who's looking to bring on a business development function, trying to understand what exactly that person should do, how they should be comped, how the company should support that person, and then, you know, how to consider things like M&A, how marketing works, our team sales. So someone in that position who is sitting there saying, our company needs to start to grow at a higher capacity with larger level deals, more zeros in your deals than the ones you're doing now, and we need to find a new market to do that. And then buy this book, because this is how it helps you think through that.
Hmm. Okay, so anyone working with business development, what do you think are some of the essential characteristics of this person who's in this role working with a startup, a tech startup, that they need to have or develop as part of this role?
You know, BD roles, I do have a list in the book, and I'm not going to recite it, but I think you know, it's a person who can develop long-term relationships. It's a person who, you know, probably has a higher strategic acumen than a salesperson, you know, maybe some more, probably more educated, an ex-banker, consultant, someone who can really think through bigger problems, someone who likes the product, can get in to really understand it. So knows how to change it, knows how to do things. And then you've got the kind of the regular personality traits, which are just very persevering, patient, and they just know how to get things over the finish line. And I think, you know, you don't want somebody in that position who hasn't delivered a lot of deals. And so they have to have a track record of having done it.
What would you say? I mean, since you spent time in Silicon Valley and in many other geographies, what do you think is different in working in Silicon Valley and maybe the benefits of being in that environment versus if you are in any other geography where maybe you don't have the same talent pool, the same ecosystem? And how is that changing? Is it changing, or is it still Silicon Valley the best place to be today?
Well, yeah, I don't spend a lot of time in Silicon Valley. I'm in kind of North Carolina. I have really no desire to be there. I don't think it's, I think Silicon Valley is how to discreetly say this. I think it's kind of an ugly place these days, but that's just my opinion. But there's reasons to think that. I think lots of people are doing really cool things around the world in energy, not coming out of Silicon Valley, right?
That's
like
true.
Most of the cool energy, the people who are actually trying to do good in the world don't come
change
from Silicon
the
Valley anymore. They're very myopic. They are people who've come out of California who want to stay there because it's the best place in the world. A lot of them haven't lived abroad, haven't traveled, or they're immigrants who just came to Silicon Valley and made millions of dollars and just stay there. So I actually have a very dim view of that place. And the people are extremely transactional. And they're highly, highly, like I said, the stuff that's coming out of there is not that interesting. And the stuff that people are doing around the world and around the rest of the US with clean tech, with other technologies are way more exciting. And I think they're going to succeed. And they're also hiring people, you know, not people who don't make as much money, but are really excited about having jobs. You know, people are like, oh, so, you know, so feel sorry for the tech workers. You know, you guys have been so spoiled the last 10 years. Like, forget it. Like, I don't feel sorry for any of you. Now go to work. Like, go do something.
Yeah.
So it's like a different place. And so I don't mind going back. I have friends there. I think some people are doing good things. You know, this whole Web3.0 cryptocurrency, all that stuff, like, forget it. You guys go back to your fun and games.
I think I would agree with your point of view. And I think, you know, sometimes I listen to some podcasts from people from there, and it's just like the culture, this hustle culture, slaving everyone kind of to the ground. And I think there are other ways of creating great products and great companies in which you can have a family life and, you know, not get burnt out. But it seems like in Silicon Valley and kind of the hustle culture that's kind of promoted there, it's almost like that's a prerequisite. Like, you should be able to sleep in the office.
I think there's, you know, for young people who are trying to start companies and they want to live that life, like, I think there's in getting startups off the ground, there is some merit in that world. And there are some reasons why, like, probably Figma became Figma because they hired a bunch of 20-year-olds and
that's
who worked
true.
Day and night, and they built the, you know, next thing. And so there's some merit to some
that
of that.
True.
But I think at certain stages of life and certain times, you know, it's not for everybody.
Yeah, that's a good point. So if you're early in your career, just graduated from college, like, and if you just want a very steep learning curve, right, and just want to just go and work and learn as much as you want, like, you could throw yourself into Silicon Valley and get, you know, 5 years of experience working in tech and the kind of experience that would, like, maybe help you go and get the exposure you won't get elsewhere.
Yeah. True. But on the flip side, I would never encourage anyone to do that because I think in your 20s, you can do a lot of things in life. Especially now, there's why work 80-hour works just because you want to go make, be a billion, you know, worth millions of dollars by the time you're 30. Like, yeah, you could go like take a year off and travel. You can go do lots of other things.
That is true.
Maybe you don't sit around and do that and you actually have a girlfriend. Or even girls now, the women now want to do this. So like, actually, maybe you should go have a boyfriend instead of doing it. It's flipped because it's both now. It's both now.
Yeah. It's true.
So it's not different. Yeah.
And the Gen Zers have different values. And I agree with that. I mean, I traveled a lot in my 20s. And I think in retrospect, sometimes I talk to some other people who are now like in their 30s, maybe with kids. And they're just like, you know, I wish I had traveled more back then when I was more like freer, like I could take more risks. I didn't need to think about like putting money on the table. And in the end,
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say in the end, like life's just going to pass you by, right? So whatever you do, you have to kind of enjoy the process, the journey. Sure.
And I will be saying, and I can say this as someone who got sucked into a lot of that and lived a certain life. And I would say to you right now, like, I would never go down that path again. Like, you know, Finding Soul is about burning myself, you know, over this startup journey. And, no one's going to pull you aside and say, hey, maybe you should change your way. Like nobody, if you're working an 80-hour work week, the only thing they're going to say to you is work 81 hours. Cause like, no one gives a shit about your well-being, right? Like no one gives a shit. Investors don't care. Vinod Khosla doesn't care. Bill Gates doesn't care. And so I think the world might be changing, but I think it's your onus to sit there and say, this is what I want, or I just want to go.
Exactly. Yeah. You need to, assert your boundaries.
You need to own it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So,
but like at the same time, like, you know, the BOGU thing, like it was a wonderful experience too, because I got to work abroad. There are things I wanted to do. I got, so in some ways it was very fortuitous for me and I was very happy to work a lot at the time. And I don't ever regret it, but I'm saying is you can't go down that route. And for me, it was different, but like, you can't go down that route and it can be backfire. Mm-hmm. So just be careful if you're young and you're doing that.
Yeah, no, thank you. I think those are some really wise words on for anybody who's maybe starting off their career, thinking about joining the startup world or investing.
And you have time, right?
And
you have patience, right? Like you do learn a lot. You can, you know, I worked for great people. I was able to get a great experience at BOGU. I worked for a lot of really senior executives and managers and whatever else who I learned a lot from. And I wouldn't be running this company today if I didn't do that. And, you know, at 45, it's fine. Like, you know, there's no necessarily rush to do these things to create the next. So be patient, enjoy your life, learn along the way. And if you find a situation where there's just something you can't say no to, it's just a wonderful concept or something that, you know, you really want to go do, that's the time to go do it. But don't force it. Like, just don't say, I have to be an entrepreneur and go work on it and build something. I just think that's the mentality that get kids into trouble. And I see a lot of youngsters get into trouble doing this. A lot. Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. I think that's a great note to end on. Anyone who's interested in learning about more of what Kurt has done, you have a website or any way that people can get in touch with you, Kurt?
Sure. My website is www.kdkurtdavisalive.com. Because I'm alive still. And so you can go there, see my travels. It's all about travels, well-being, what I'm doing. And then my books are there. And you can just read up and see what I have to say. And sometimes it's controversial. Not too controversial, but I can be a little edgy sometimes.
No. People want to hear what other people think, right? Like, you don't want to gloss over like the challenges or like the things that you disagree with. I think that's why I often pick a book, is when someone has a point of view that's different from the masses. So thank you so much for coming on here. Thank you for sharing some of your tips for anyone in business development, anyone who's interested in being a founder. I think there's a lot of good tips that you shared, and we can go check out your book, Navigate to the Lighthouse, A Silicon Valley Guide to Executing Global Deals. So anyone trying to get these big deals, read the book, so you can learn from Kurt's journey. So thank you so much for joining and hope to see you soon.
Thank you. Okay. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Braving Innovation Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, do hit subscribe so you do not miss any of our future episodes. Don't forget to leave us a review and share this podcast with others who might find it valuable. Thank you.